Welcome to Green Planet, Blue Planet podcast. I am here today with Alessandro Mazzi from Sovereign Nature Initiative. Welcome, Alessandro.
Thank you. Thank you, Julian, for having me. And yeah, I look forward to the dialogue.
Yeah, I'm really curious about your story and your journey to, you know, work with Sovereign Nature Initiative, with I think, you know, like the Kenya Wildlife Trust, and maybe start a little bit on the journey part of it. Like how does one who, you know, born in Italy, lived in Amsterdam for many years, now in Portugal, how did that happen for you that you're involved in this way with wildlife protection in Africa?
Sure. Yeah, it was quite a journey. And but I would say it starts with the deep love that I have since I was a little kid for the environment and nature, and the deep mystery of the natural world that sort of characterized the first part of my life a lot. And then, of course, you start to study and get to school, and it's not very cool to be looking for worms and ants in underground. So I sort of left a bit of that love in pause for some time. I studied law, environmental law, so still that influence and that passion that I had for the environment stayed with me. And after graduating, I started to work in the tech space, and pretty early in the blockchain space, and blockchain applied to sustainability. And long story short, that's how I got to meet the Sovereign Nature Initiative very early. Now it's 3 years ago, around 2.5 years ago. We met in a hackathon that they organized around the use of blockchain for the enforcement and implementation of the UN Treaty on the High Seas. So this was very experimental, very early. Yeah, they made me an offer to join them and build together with the founders the initiative. So I was one of the first to join, and it's been quite a ride. So the question of the Sovereign Nature Initiative that we always asked was, how can technology be in service to a thriving planet? From questions of governance to questions of economics, how can we value nature more for being alive than dead? And around that, we organized right now three hackathons. The first two were very experimental. One was connected to a project in Amsterdam called the COVO, which was a regenerative project. And then the last one was with the Kenya Wildlife Trust, which is an organization based in Kenya, in the Masai Mara, and their mandate is to protect predators in this ecosystem, which is called the Greater Masai Mara ecosystem. And their technical questions, let's say, that they wanted teams that participate in the hackathon to address were on lion identification, which is very important for them to inform policy, knowing exactly what lion is and to do it in an efficient way. And then the second one is to build technology that could support the mitigation of human wildlife conflict. Through that experiment, all that R&D program that we organized, so we invited teams from mostly from Kenya and East Africa to participate. We got to understand a Sovereign Nature Initiative that data collection was the biggest chunk of work that the conservation organizations was doing, and that was very important, although funds were always lacking to support the data collection and analysis process that then would allow them to take policies on how to better conserve and work with people that live adjacent to these protected areas, so communities and so on. Yeah, I can talk about what we did after understanding that.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear more about it. But before you go there, you also just recently published a TED Talk about relating with the living earth and how that matters. And I think I'm personally so with you on this. I just want to hear your opinion, Alessandro, about how come that over and over the conversation is how to use tech for good for the healthy planet, when really it, there is another part of it, which is like relating to the living earth that matters, right? Which is something you've gained like such insight and such a positive desire for life. And that's what you're sharing in that TED Talk. How do you see those two kind of polarities play together, right? Like tech for good, which is like, yeah, you take it from there. How do you kind of navigate between those two polarities?
Yeah, no, thanks so much. So it's a great question. I wouldn't call them polarities, but to bring them together as a triplicate, let's say. So you have, like you said, the being or being in awe with nature as the first step. And in that TED Talk, I sort of explained that how that, as in my first person experience, always inspired a more relational, a more, I would say, complex type of thinking around what is nature. You know, ecology is about how do we understand the, call it the biosphere, the natural world. So by through that thinking that looks things relationally, looks at ourselves as individual in relation to the larger community of life, from that type of thinking then we can start to build stuff. So that's the third, the tech, the capacity, the hands to manipulate, if you want, the natural environment. But if we understand that we are intrinsic, that we are connected integrally with other living beings, when we build technology from that place, we can we will likely not or less likely do damage, because sometimes that's the case, even if the
intention right. That's like, that's one of the core conversations in all things AI, right? It's like, who's building it and with what intentions, because it really does matter. And if we're fundamentally connected to nature and all living beings, likely it creates a different outcome.
Friend recently, Jonathan Ledgar, said, how can we make AI love nature?
That's a really good question.
Thought experiment. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it made me think.
Yeah, I mean, that makes me think, if we can make machines love anything, like, you know, we don't really understand love ourselves in the first place. So how to teach a machine that we know is more like based on parameters. I think the important through line here is to not forget that we are not machines.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that idea of a machine, and then from there, you know, we think that with machines we control the machines. It's very it's so wrong that everyone knows, but we act as if we are machines, and that's
Well, that's why I wanted to ask this question early in this episode today, just to really understand where you see, I call them polarities in the sense that they are kind of two ends of the spectrum, but yeah, they're also, you know, they're very connected, right? It's like what we do with technology and how we relate to the living world. So bringing this back to kind of the work of bridging like the fascinating dynamics of predators with the interactions of online creative communities, what's the call to action? How can people participate, and how is this exciting for people all around the world?
Yeah, so the basically what we came up with all this data about lions and pride dynamics, the groups dynamics of the lions, and we offered those to this gaming community called Monsama. They have created lion avatars that they use in their in-game for in-game purposes. And what is now, and this we're talking about right now, so we still have to see what the effect on the community itself is. But one of the things that we are really interested in is to basically bridging these separate worlds together, so they can learn from each other, especially the gaming community, which is very much detached from nature and bigger issues like a human-wildlife conflict. Can learn about those. So through the games, through what they do and love the most, plus by purchasing those avatars, they're also contributing to the Kinova Life Trust, so they can the proceeds that are generated through the games are benefiting the Kenya Wildlife Trust and their work. So there is this greater purpose than just using that as a utility for your game, and how people can participate right now with Munsama. It's their communities, a thousand members. But in the future, it will be expanded to other games. So people that for now are gamers or digital asset creators could benefit, create art, for instance, and then sell it and benefit.
And you're also working as the head of partnerships, right, for the Sovereign Nature Initiative. So like you're basically also looking to expand those partnerships so that more communities can onboard into kind of connecting their people and their tribe into nature-based initiatives like in Kenya and with the Kenya Wildlife Trust.
Yeah, so my role is to actually expand the impact from the side of the conservation organization. So I'm the one in touch with other projects beyond the Kenya Wildlife Trust now that want to onboard on this journey of, you know, using alternative crowdfunding model, if you may, or funding models for conservation, and also not only for funds but also for greater engagement and new possibilities to tell them how they can tell their stories to the world.
Yeah, I'm really curious to hear a few more stories from you right now about, you know, the way that love for the natural world has started to really take over your mind, your consciousness, your heart, and the way you operate. So in your TED talk, you're talking about, you know, these encounters with dolphins and sharks and other, you know, just amazing animals in the natural world. What, you know, maybe if you want to tell like one or two stories or examples, like what happened to you? Like where were you before, and then how did those encounters really change you?
Yeah, so there were the early memories of when I was a kid, and I think, yeah, on the tech talk I shared one which was very powerful, also involving dolphins. And then basically I've always been curious about what does it mean to be human in relation to animals. So there was always this attraction and curiosity towards like getting close to animals, wild or not. And I would say, I mean, the latest one was when I was at the Old Pejeta Conservancy in Kenya, I think 3 weeks ago. And we were tracking lions. They were collared with some rangers there to see what they were doing, whether the cubs were there and so on. So it's part of like their monitoring process. So we went to track them and we saw them, and we spent around an hour around the two females and their, what was it, four cubs. The intensity of the look of those lions while I was taking pictures of them, for instance, or just like looking at them, not through the lens of the camera. Those are like what I would call deep experiences, where you feel like there's a communication starting between you and the animal. There's no separation anymore. There's this I'm looking at you, I'm looking away, while I look away you calm, you know, like there are all these interactions and so on that were pretty powerful and just make you expand your sense of self to include others. There are also moments. I remember once in the Kruger National Park in South Africa, where I was just sitting on on a big rock on a hill and just looking at the sun rising with a friend. And all of a sudden my mind started to think about the relationship between the clouds. There was some rain some kilometers away, the grass, and that, as I went in through that thinking, I started crying all of a sudden, which was very surprising for me, and I didn't know what it was, but what triggered it. It was no sadness or no happiness, but just the awe of looking at how complex and beautiful the world is. Those are, again, reminders to me, and we need those reminders, I guess, more often.
They're like transcendent experiences of awe, right? Like, as you said, like this relation with just the gaze between a lion and you, or like the presence that kind of happens in that space.
Yeah, definitely.
Go ahead.
No, and that sort of always inspires me to create. If we create any technologies, we create technology that comes from that place, and also, you know, sometimes we might not need technology actually most of the time, as you dig into some of the problems.
Right.
It's more than that, you know. So, and that's what you realize. Those moments makes you humble, makes you you feel like you're not that special, although you're making a lot of changes around you as a human being.
Yeah, we humans and our desire to be individually acknowledged for being special. That is quite an interesting one. But I also really, what I hear you say, Alessandro, is that there is a need to have those, you know, like moments of rapture or moments of awe, and have those in nature with animals or with the natural world, you know, because trees are alive beings as well, and they just don't move as much as animals. But that moment when we feel that there is something bigger than just our individual self, right, or that feeling of connection, that actually makes us great creators. And I'd be totally with you. I think personally that maybe most of our problems wouldn't even exist if we created everything from that place, right? But since we are in that modern society that we are, I really love that this is where this episode's conversation is going towards, is the point is to create technology from a consciousness understanding and balance of understanding nature first, of honoring nature first, of loving nature first, of feeling one with nature first, because then the technology won't be destructive to the world that we place it into, rather than building these like crazy AI experiments where the question is, can I program an AI that will become smarter than me, so it will outsmart, like, that's kind of an interesting point of view that, you know, that maybe comes more from Silicon Valley or different cohorts, where it's all about, can we make the machine more powerful than us, which I don't think is a very intelligent question to follow, because you know, can the machine become an ally for all of life is a much more aligned perspective in my personal opinion.
Yeah, and what came to mind is, I mean, we don't, if we would only understand complexity, then we can create a machine that could understand it better, but we don't. And I mean, there's a useful distinction between complicated and complex that Dave Snowden, who is an academic, as a sociologist of all sorts, makes. And what complexity is what nature is, and the fact that processes continuously change. There is this dynamic relationship where you can actually not predict what a system will do, and complicated is a machine, is a zero and ones. It's something that if it breaks, it doesn't repair, for instance, and we still treat, let's say, those as same as you said. The idea of an AI, for instance, that recently, so just to save AI, because I think there is still a lot of space there. There's a project, I cannot remember exactly the name, that worked on translating whale and dolphin. Maybe that's I'm biased with the choice of species, but basically they are trying to translate their language into human language and then human language into dolphin language so we can start a communication path. I love the idea. I love the idea of just a communication, a verbal communication type of exchange to hear also finally what they tell to each other and what they tell to us. Although swimming with dolphins, it also starts a communication between the two of you. It's just not verbal.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I absolutely hear you. There's, I'll share a story or two into like my personal fascination with these transcendent nature moments. I told you before we hit record, I've been living in the Pacific Northwest of British Columbia, for the last, decade or so. Most of my year I spent here and then the rest I spent traveling, but both eagles and whales, specifically killer whales, have a fascinating energetic presence. And I've gotten lucky enough to be kind of eye to eye with a bald eagle several times where, for one, they're so much more patient than us, right? Because they can sit in the same spot for hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours. And, spending as little as half an hour just staring into their eye from a few dozens of meters away or so, or with binoculars, you realize they actually stare right deep into your soul. And they're eagles, right? So there's a reason that we call it like you have eagle eyes, because they really see you. You can notice in the way the pupils are kind of adjusting, they track. And with that tracking, there's that moment of connection where you realize, oh wow, we're in the same space right now. Whew. And it's this transcendent kind of awe-striking moment where, and when that first happened to me a few years ago, I remember I had like a call or something on a computer and I totally forgot about it and missed the person, because it was just so much less important than being present in that moment and being taken by that rapture.
Mm-hmm.
And with whales, because you were saying about the verbal communication, like, yeah, it would be fascinating, but really my personal thought is maybe whales and dolphins and species like that are extremely intelligent, right? Maybe they don't even need to verbally communicate. There's a lot of energetic and presence-based communication, right? Like in human terms, maybe like body language. I remember this one time, I was actually sitting on the beach down here and I just had this intuition to keep walking on the beach and it hit me really hard. I got this image into my mind that I'm about to go see orcas. And, sounds a little far out, but actually what happened was I changed my plans and just kept walking on the beach. And about 10 minutes later, the orcas swam by. And, on Vancouver Island, this is, these things do happen. But at the same time, it was like a premonition about 10 minutes earlier. And so I asked myself, like, where does this premonition come from, right? Like, is this a communication that's just me with my intuition and I was just really switched on that day? Or is that in the larger field and the whales are communicating where they're coming through, or like it's just really curious to me. And I'm not sure if machines will really help us understand that, right? But yeah, we drifted off into both of our fascination of animals and large creatures, which I think is a very, very good thing to remember for everyone tuning into this, is we want to build a healthy planet from this love of nature, right? Because that's how we actually build a healthy planet.
Yes, and the topic of ecological, I would say, use the word ecological and not environmental, simply because it includes the environment has always been as this history of being something out there, and then there's something in here. So there's already a dichotomy in that word. So I use ecological, but ecological ethics has been a very interesting, incredibly interesting, fascinating topic for me. And one of the reasons why I chose law, actually. Trying to find some sort of, law has tried many times to try to find a way for everyone to cohere around the importance of everything living, right? Because we inherit that, there is some sort of duty towards that, towards our ancestors, humans and non-humans, and then there is a responsibility to keep that for the future in some way. So I mean, as far as we can. So anything that falls short and has to fulfill a short-term type of need cannot be done if it's not, you know, to maintain a continuity of call it ecological integrity or the health of the entire ecosystem, including humans, because I think we also have an obligation towards the evolutionary processes to keep ourselves in the game. Let's say
you're making a huge point there, right? Because we're seeing like the decline of health in our species through the foods we're eating, the glyphosate in the soil, in the water, you know, the technology choices we're making by like kind of decreasing our mental and intellectual capacities to like become 3-second attention span people and being like dopamine addicted through our devices. So you're right, like our own health is actually on, as a species speaking, on decline, our reproductive health as well, which I think is a absolutely staggering warning signal to be like, oh, this modern progress might not be progress after all. And an ecological awareness and balance is, you know, kind of like the next logical step to realize we're just one item, one participant in that ecological circle of all of life, right? And as we understand that role, we'll definitely make different choices. And I find this quite visible at this point in our reality, but I find it still quite difficult in a modern society personally. How do you relate to that when you travel, when you're walking through this modern world? Like, do you find it's easy to make really wise choices, or do you still find it's kind of hard as a consumer? You know, like you're dependent on where you are, you're dependent on the supermarket, you're dependent on kind of the circumstances. How do you relate to that complexity yourself?
Yeah, so there are limiting constraints of living in a system. So that doesn't allow positive intentions to be fulfilled. I mean, you go to a supermarket, if you want to survive, you cannot just spend like a whole day figuring out what is the best food, where it's coming from. And sometimes you just don't know it, right? So you don't have access to that information. So I struggle a lot with that, of course, because there's nothing more painful than not being able to follow your heart and where you're going, but yeah, again, accepting that there are these limiting constraints. Another thing, it's to see people, so outside of me, also struggling a lot with that, and also struggling more than just if there is the intention in people, then I'm already happy about that. But if there's not that intention because of some political division that is made around an ecological question, or you know, should we cut emissions or not, and people choose parts because that's what the media, you know, tell them, choose right or left, and this makes me sad and makes me pessimistic about it, because it's not about changing the system itself, but it's about changing consciousness and people's understanding about the world. So back to again, experiences of with nature, but also experiences of collective just being together as humans is very important. And it seems this is not the system, but the narrative is more and more about separation between us as well. So the work that we can do as humans between us, his community, is open dialogues, is to recreate, I mean, the government that we want, you know, the governments between us that we want, that are in service to our own mental, emotional well-being and the well-being of others, other beings too. Yeah, it's so that those are the limiting constraints I see, the enabling constraints I see, meaning they can help us move forward. One is education, I feel. I feel I always end up there when looking for solutions. And education in my field, let's say, of conservation, wildlife conservation, human wildlife conflict, is ecological education, understanding what are the animals around you, how are you affecting them within your environment where you live, and how do they behave, and how I make sure that we can coexist. As a very simple example that I saw also in Kenya, for instance, been done, where they go and teach to kids that live adjacent to these protected areas what are predators, what are lions, how do they behave, what they should be careful with, to not create conflicts and so on. So
that's definitely a big enabling factor, is the way we educate and the way we carry the message forward, right? Because these days every kid is growing up with a cell phone in their hand, and that was not the case 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and so it changes the game. What would be your advice to anyone who is, like, you know, I don't know, 15 to 20, who's tuned into this? What would you tell the younger generation that's, like, coming into adulthood? What is required in this modern world? What's important to look out for?
I would say, to start to look at themselves as relational beings and not as individuals, which for teenagers, it's pretty hard. I remember it's all about finding your own identity. But if you start from that early age to look at yourself as a conglomerate of different things, from language to your friends, to your parents, to beyond humans, to you, we have bacteria in the guts, we have all sorts of pieces from all the way down the evolutionary chain that makes us who we are. We have brains that we share with dolphins, with crocodiles, we have parts of the brains that every animal have. So we embody that. So understanding that is one. And through that, so you don't need to study ecology or anything to, like, scientific to understand those principles. And from there, it will be easier to do anything that is in service to something larger than your own self. In terms of, how they should be with each other, I think community, starting to practice community from an early age, and not just these little tribes, you know, just community of care and trust is very important. I haven't seen much happening at that age. It usually starts later when you realize, like, oh my God, we humans need humans, so let's be together. And leaving smartphones for the only, you know, only times where we really need them, I think it's a good one.
That's too, a big one.
Say. Yeah.
I personally have trouble with that, you know, like,
I
definitely know how to put it away and put it on airplane mode, but it still is, like, you got to really train yourself to do that, no? Because it calls you back every minute, basically.
Yeah. The phone always looks at you. It's like almost, it's just looking at you like, please, attention, please.
Right? And over decades, it moved closer and closer and closer to the human body. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's an extension of ourselves. And it's not necessarily bad. It's the type of a relationship, the right relationship that you have to build with technology in general. When targeting games, the example that we brought up, games can be an incredible educational tool, but also can be a way that we get addicted to, again, an extra thing.
Deep breath here for the state of the world, right? I think it's such a fascinating time to be alive, because the contrast is so rich, but at the same time, there's so much opportunity and really, like, a a healthy planet that wants to be created. And it is, you know, this is also part of the theme of Green Planet, Blue Planet, is who are the people that are really standing in and up for that? And I think there are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people that are actively co-creating a thriving world. And, you know, more and more, I think we're seeing that this might turn into a large direction of like our entire species. But for now, there's still like a lot of challenges. Where do you personally land between like pessimism and optimism? You said earlier some things make you pessimistic, but you strike me as an optimist based on your love of nature. Like how does that feel for you?
It's funny you asked this question, because literally like 4 days ago, a colleague of mine described me as contrarian optimist. So, and what that means is, it's an actual definition, something along the lines of a personality that doesn't accept the status quo, but doesn't stop there. So you can have a contrarian pessimist that just says the world is going to shit, the capitalism is the way, there's no way out of it. And to me, it's like, I cannot stop there. I cannot stop into like, okay, let's say capitalism, whatever it is, a human greed is who we are. Hence, we should just not do anything. I'm like, okay, this is definitely not who we are. It's part of who we are. What else is there? And how can we move forward? So I also find pessimism. So being optimistic, I don't want it to be something like being naive, right? So just positivity for the sake of positivity is definitely super toxic.
Yeah.
But optimism that is grounded on there is actual possibility. And for me, optimism has always meant curiosity, first of all. Like, I've always been curious. It's like, what's more, what's next? How can we change it? And I just see there's no use of being pessimistic. Mm. There is use of being critical, and use of being, contrarian.
Contrarian. I like what you just said about curiosity. It seems to me that curiosity might be one of the superpowers of the human species. Right, so, or maybe it's even across many species, but it's a superpower, because if you let's just bracket for a second that in the industrial education system kind of tries to drive it out of you, and you just perform all the right actions and none of the wrong actions. But you know, that aside, if you're following your curiosity, you're kind of following also the impulse of life, right? The direction of like how consciousness wants to expand through us.
Totally. I mean, in evolutionary theory, there is like, it's called like explorer mode. It's almost like this, like as you said, is the drive to look for more, let's say, complexification, to adding more to life. And I believe evolutionary theory explains that it was sort of like growing more and more complex, right? So from single cells to us, let's say, there is an increase of complexity. I mean, there's arguments against that as well, but I believe the curiosity, attraction as well. So, which is same thing, attraction between two humans or two animals to create a new being, you know, and all that. It's a force of, let's call it the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And curiosity is one way, beautiful way to see ourselves embodying that energy, that power. I feel that one of the most, the strongest critiques I have of like society these days, or culture, or actually more, is the lack of curiosity, as if we, and this saddens me often, that it's almost as if we have accepted that things are the way they are, and then we stop. It's like my biggest nightmare. But that's how I see oftentimes people act from that place.
Yeah, I think this is the exciting part about being alive, is that we don't know all the answers. We haven't discovered it all yet, right? Well, Alessandro, thank you so much for the time that you've had here with us in this episode, and all of the work you do across the world and in the different initiatives, and, you know, building tech from a place of being being in love with nature, right? Having these like deeply connected experiences. I think that's, for me, the main theme of this interview and this episode. It's such a powerful reminder and such a positive and you know, like, pertinent to our times, because we're at this crossroads where we can continue the industrialization and the you know, robotization of humans in our world, or we can really realize that, like, we're part of an ecology, and as that, like, when we act and live from awe and rapture with nature, we will create a fundamentally different reality. And it is not a conversation of against or pro technology, right? As you said, like, I would go back to the example of the knife. Like, you can use a knife to cut bread or to hurt someone, right? It's about the education and the intent, and then also the understanding of the larger kind of context in which we use things in. And so is there anything else you'd love to share, any call to action, anything, anywhere where people can find you, anything that will, you know, to call into your life as we're closing this interview?
Sure. So I invite everyone to check out the work that we're doing with the Sovereign Nature Initiative and how that is evolving, and this very exciting new proposal of bringing ecological conservation data to games and other organizations beyond the Kenya Wildlife Trust. For the rest, reach out if you're curious about our work beyond the technologies that we develop, but also the topics that we cover often in workshops and talks. So reach out.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Alessandro.
Thank you so much, Julian. And speak soon.